Thanks a lot, Ilkka. So it's been a pretty hectic life. I worked for Natural Motion for a couple of years, and then last Thursday I fly back there. I was working obviously for Sirius already, and I get just the news that okay, now the company's been sold to Zynga. So it was kind of interesting turn of events. So obviously on Friday everyone hits the pub there, and it's just madness. So yeah, it's a good time to be come back to Finland. I'm moving back next week. So I'm not a, I'm not a massive super seminar talker guy. I'm primarily a game designer, so I'm not a very theoretical person. I was looking at the list of speakers you guys have here, so you have a really massively talented group of guys here, and from kind of all walks of life. So I was kind of this being the midpoint of the your kind of course. I was trying to kind of tailor this presentation so that it kind of covers a lot of stuff. So it's some kind of medley of things I've kind of personally learned within the last 10 years of working in game design. So it works, yes. So yeah, I'm Reko Ukko. I have a pretty long background in graphics. So I used to do a lot of 3D graphics, illustration, what have you. A bit of demo scene background as well. I used to do graphics there. Around 10 years ago, I went to Bugbear Entertainment, who did flat-out games, all this crash racing stuff, and I started as a game designer there. I used to do a bit of graphics there, but then the CEO basically pulled me over and, Reko, how about if you do some game design? And I was like, yeah, that sounds fantastic. I had no idea what it means, but it's I'm a game designer. Who wouldn't want to do games and not graphics? So yeah, that sounded perfect. So that's kind of my that was kind of my fire test for the industry. And obviously, it was a very different industry back then. Already on that first summer, I did massive crunches and whatnot. So it was okay, so this is what it is. So it's been changing quite a lot. So I started at Bugbear Entertainment, then went on to work at Digital Chocolate, which was a complete, I had a bit of a change in life there. So I went to Digital Chocolate and I was kind of unsure, what is this going to be, mobile games and all that. This was in 2007. And it was quite interesting. It was really hard to even going there to understand back in the day, so do people play games on mobile? How do you get those games? How do you even discover them? Are they fun? How can they be fun at all when you can play Fallout and all these games on PC and console? And it was quite strange. But then it kind of turned out that, well, actually, these are really fun games and they do serve their purpose. If you're hanging around somewhere, have a bit of time to spend, just put out a game. And the tagline for Digital Chocolate used to be "Seize the Minute," which on hindsight was way, way, way too early, because the time when we seize the minute is right now. And Digital Chocolate was founded in 2004. So they were way early on the market, and they were doing a lot of Symbian games for Nokia and all those hundreds of different phones. And I luckily kind of escaped the most kind of horrible period of the Symbian development. So back in the day when you were working on those games, you basically had to do a separate game for each individual phone there. So, and especially some of the low-end phones, the graphics are so tiny that you can even hardly see your game anymore. And someone had to do that stuff. And luckily, I kind of escaped that. I did high-end stuff. I did N95 and those really good phones back in the day. After Digital Chocolate, or maybe I'll talk about Digital Chocolate a bit more, because it's still kind of, it's very close to heart. Digital Chocolate, I kind of think that it is one of the, it's kind of like one of the grounding stones of the Finnish game development industry. A lot of really talented stuff, and especially now in the mobile era, it's kind of come to fruition that those guys, especially in the Helsinki studio, they are kind of now utilizing what they learned back then. The mobile devices are still out there, they're just a lot more powerful. Hello. So Digital Chocolate went through a lot. We did mobile games first, then we pivoted and did Facebook games because that was all the rage. It was Ilkka Paananen is the main culprit for me being very active in Facebook today, because he just told everyone in the all staffer that, hey, check out Facebook, it's really awesome, and that's when I was hooked. So yeah, Facebook is really nice. We did those games for a while. We had an early start on the iOS development as well. I think some of the games that Digital Chocolate made were one of the first ones that actually had in-app purchases, which is nowadays really cool. But back in the day when we were doing those, we were basically asking Apple that, okay, so how do we do the in-app purchases in your system? And they basically said that, well, I have no idea. Like, I don't know how it's done. Like, you tell us what's the best flow, basically. And then they started kind of working on it, and nowadays in-app purchases are everywhere. After Digital Chocolate, I went to work at Remedy for a while. I kind of felt that I need a bit of a change in pace. I really, really, really loved Alan Wake, and I was kind of really, really hoping that whatever game they're going to making, it has to be Alan Wake too. I really want to work on that. So then I went there, and yeah, let's do it, and I saw all this kind of material there. And then they started pre-production on Quantum Break, and it was like, okay, well, it's a bit different, but it was a fun period. And I was kind of like, okay, so sure, I'm going to work on this AAA thing for the next-gen consoles, and that's not too bad. Not many people get to do that. And one day a headhunter kind of gets in touch, and he's kind of like, so would you be interested in this kind of a position? And I typically turn them down because it's a very run-of-the-mill stuff. They just spam you on LinkedIn like all the time, and they never tell you anything, and it's just a bit of a... It's a bit shit. But this particular headhunter was very nice. So he had actually written a really nice letter to me. And then 2 weeks later, I decided I reply and say that, yeah, I mean, that's really nicely done, but no. And then he mentioned that, yeah, it's actually in Oxford in UK. Now, that's a bit tough because I grew up playing pen and paper role-playing games, and I love castles and moats and medieval history and all that stuff. I've never been to the UK, and now there's a company that wants to kind of like have a chat with me there in the UK. We have a 20-minute chat over the phone, and then I hear a door go, like, kind of open and close. And then the guys interviewing me tell me that, oh, shit, like, we have to go. Like, someone else has booked this room. So when you're on a kind of heated Skype discussion with, like, these guys who might be your future employees, and you're expecting, like, 1.5 hours of, like, massive grilling over Skype, you barely have a 20-minute conversation with the guys, and then they just suddenly quit. And then you're just like, okay, I guess that didn't go too well. But then a week later, they wanted to fly me into Oxford. So that was like, well, okay, that's my ticket. I'm going to finally visit UK. Like all these years, like 30 years in the county. So I went there, and then it's like, well, it's for a person who's never been in UK, Oxford is a pretty nice stop to do. It looks pretty beautiful. And it was like, it was hard to like think about not accepting it. And then I just decided to go there. So I went to Natural Motion. It's Natural Motion's been around for a long time, 12 years, 13 years, something like that. Their pedigree is in high-quality animation. They do middleware engines, which is used in all Rockstar games like Grand Theft Auto and all that stuff. They basically have animation engines that simulate like how a human learns to move. So it's not animation at all. It's an AI that controls the like walk and all that stuff. And they basically kind of spun off and did a game studio and then pivoted a couple of times to do free-to-play games. So that was interesting. I was almost in a similar circumstance as I was in Digital Chocolate, because Digital Chocolate did a really kind of fast pivot to free-to-play games. And we went through a lot of discussions. Some people left because they thought that, well, they're not games anymore and it's not fun and all that stuff. And then I landed in Natural Motion and I started having those same discussions and having this really strong deja vu feeling that, wait a minute, having these discussions before. So it was the same thing, company pivoting to free-to-play games. I think UK in general was way behind the curve when it came to Finland, so it felt like in 2012, when I went there on January or February, I thought I was having kind of the... It felt that the industry there was where Finland was in 2008, 2009. So just about like you had these kind of new companies coming into the market, and a lot of the old guard was kind of really kind of struggling to think like, how do we make games in the future? What does it actually mean? So work with a lot of games. I'm currently lead game designer and co-founder at Seriously, for real. And we had a really kind of good team on it. And I've been on it for a few months. And that's kind of like the main reason we're coming back from the UK. So I've done a lot of games. There's maybe like, I think, the total of 24 games. One kind of extra trivia bit is in the top bottom right corner. So who has used an ATM in Finland between the years 2000 to 2008? So if you have like a massive user experience gripe about that, then I'm all ears, because that was kind of my contribution to this Finnish kind of. That's, I've done a lot of stuff. They're all dead from the dot-com bubble era, but that stayed around for a long time. There was a lot of thinking that maybe I'll, because it's a flash animation that plays, so we were kind of thinking that let's put an Easter egg there. Like every 15 rotations when the animation restarts, you do some kind of a strobe effect or something. So it would be really fun to walk in the streets of Helsinki in the middle of the night and see these random flashes go on in the ATMs. But yeah, maybe it was a bit too much. Yeah, but yeah. I'm thinking about it and I kind of regret it, because it would have been a really hard thing to find out. But yeah. So the problem with game presentations such as these, when you are trying to kind of tell people like, okay, this is how you should make games and these are the things to worry about, is that obviously game making games is like just, it's 10% inspiration, which is the really fun part, and then the 90% perspiration, which is the kind of suffering and just going through and everything sucks and then it turns good. Game development is mostly about this. And once the project is done, you kind of forget all the shit that went on and all that kind of, like, you just plow on to the next project. And what happens all the time is that when you are having the tough time on development, you always think that, man, I wish I had a video camera here to kind of actually capture the process. Like, there's been many very legendary development tales in the Finnish, like, game development, like Alan Wake, and just projects that's been really hard. And you hear all these stories, but no one ever captures them. So no, actually, it all becomes this kind of legacy and myth. And then later on, you think that, well, it wasn't actually that bad. So it's hard to actually start giving really good advice that these are the things that we screwed up. So then when you have like really difficult projects, it's kind of you just want to get rid of it as fast as possible, and maybe you can point out some reasons that things failed or it didn't turn up well. And especially in free-to-play nowadays, if you just have like one shot in the market and then it just completely bombs and fails, it's really easy to kind of just blame that, well, I mean, free-to-play sucks, I didn't want to do them in the first place. And all kinds of reasons, that these are the reasons that we just failed. And then on the other hand, when you have these massive successes, it's really easy to kind of get lost in your own kind of, you are basically drinking your own Kool-Aid and kind of like, okay, so we have a smash hit here and these are obviously the reasons. And typically, like when people have these smash hits, you can one of the good pinpoints in the fact that they are actually drinking their own Kool-Aid is the fact that they start talking about stuff like, well, we have this design cookbook, and then we have this, like, these are basically, we have the secret recipe for making best games ever, forever, even though every single project is as difficult as the previous one, unless you're doing a sequel. So when it comes to, hello. So, for example, with the Candy Crush guys, when you probably ask those guys, like, so what was the most difficult bit in making, like, the whole Candy Crush thing? I'm sure they can't remember any of that, but I'm sure that the most difficult bit for those guys is that they just have so much money that all the developers are drowning, so they need to buy some push carts or something so they can get the money away, because it's harsh. So yeah, giving advice on making great games is really hard. Experiences are subjective, and especially when you get like, when you show a game that's unfinished to people, there's a lot of gripes there, but typically it's not actually the principal gripe that is the root of the reason. Like, you have to kind of look behind that. So it's really hard, like, when people kind of slag off your game and give you kind of like, I don't like this, this, and this. It's still hard to kind of find out the core reason, like, behind all of this. Like, where is that kind of negative feedback coming? So I'm kind of putting this on a, just kind of like six things I want to cover today. So first of all, let's start with like what games are actually about. Like when we start from the beginning, what was the thing that actually captured players? And that kind of leads off to the retention, which is kind of, it's a nice word for what went on beyond. Like why is it that people actually come back to the games? Then we'll look a bit about the monetization, just like on retention and monetization, I'll just talk about a few games and kind of my observations, like why is it that they are working and why is that kind of happening? Then we'll look a bit about metrics and analytics stuff. Not much. I'm primarily a game designer, so it's not like I'm not massively into the kind of big analytics backbone and the whole metrics stuff, even though I deal with that. But there are a lot of people out there who could talk about this for days. And then I'm going to give you like really good advice on how to make shit games. Like if you really want to bomb, I'm going to give you really good advice on what you should do to make sure that you really screw up. Or at least make the whole development cycle be really, really painful and really kind of like marriages break and all kinds of like you won't see the sun ever and all that stuff. And then I'm going to wax lyrical a bit on startups and game design in general. Just kind of have a bit of a thought. So how many of you guys are kind of thinking of working in the game industry? There's a fair lot here. How many do work at the game industry nowadays? Well, that's a fair lot as well. What are you doing here? Go make games. So if we think about like what games traditionally were about, like what makes them tick and what makes them magical and what's the actual hook. So imagine you have a box. Does anyone actually recognize the box? What is it? No, it's not.
Hellraiser?
Well done. It's a lament configuration box. Very evil. Imagine you have a box. It doesn't have to be like that. But imagine it has a button on it, like maybe it's on the top. And when you press it, it spouts out a few coins. And sometimes a lot of coins come out, and sometimes you press it 100 times and nothing happens. So that's kind of like, well, okay, is that a game? Do you kind of think that that's a game? Probably not. It's not a very good one, at least. But imagine that we have the same box, and then we basically add a bit of a screen on it. We add a few reels there, and when you press the box, the button, the reels start turning, and the icons on the reels basically match up, and depending on the configuration there, they give you money. So, and especially when you win big, it lights up and there's all kinds of celebratory effects, and it's all good. So what's the kind of difference between the two? Well, like what is this? What did I just describe? It's a slot machine or a one-armed bandit. So the thing that games do really well is feedback. So if you just have a box that doesn't tell you what's happening or it doesn't give you any feedback, that's not a game. It's not telling you how you are kind of succeeding. And feedback is the kind of thing that's the thing that's the kind of seed for the actual fun in games. But then when you think about the process, like when you imagine your like first time when you go to a slot machine or a one-armed bandit, like what is actually happening in the process there? You go there, you just do like this, you see the reels roll there and things kind of light up. So there's a lot happening in your mind at that point because you are essentially learning. Obviously, it is a game of chance, so there isn't much super like tricks you can learn there, but you are learning that, okay, so these configurations give me this, this, and this, and that's what I'm kind of trying to do. So then you have the opportunity to lock the reels and start kind of like, okay, so if I lock this and this, I have this kind of a chance to get that result. But that's where the actual video games really kind of start shining, because games are at the like really tail end bottom of it. They are about learning. So especially like if you think about Super Mario, like one of the first ones, when you press a button, the guy jumps, and they don't give you any instructions on what to do and how things work, and you get like instant feedback on the button press. And from there, you kind of start building this matrix in your head about how does the game work and how can I utilize what I just learned. So if you jump, you can jump on top of an enemy and take it out. You can jump on top of a platform. You can jump on a brick and it breaks, and on and on and on. And you start kind of filling this network in your head about what am I actually learning here? Like, these are the skills that I'm kind of constantly learning, and you start getting better and better and better at it. And that's skill mastery. And that is a very kind of evolutionary thing. But in games, it just happens on a very, very like lightning speed. Like, when you guys are studying in school, you are obviously learning all the time, all kinds of stuff, but you don't actually get like a massive amount of feedback about, hey, now I'm just this much better on mathematics or whatever. But in games, the fact that you are learning and the fact that the feedback is so rapid, that's what makes it magical, and that's what makes it kind of really sticky in terms of like, hey, I want to really get better at this. So it's especially evolutionary, like when you look at all these nice nature documentaries about tigers and lions who are kind of fighting in the savannah and all that stuff. And that's for all the lions, that is just play. Like, you see the cubs kind of roll around on the ground and they are kind of playing around. But that is actually learning for them as well, because they are basically learning how to cope once they are adults. So it is a kind of this kind of the feedback, the need to learn, that's kind of built in into humans as well. And games are the ones that's why people talk a lot about gamification and all those elements, that kind of, it kind of supercharges your learning because the feedback is so fast. So games are about learning. And then if you think about the skill mastery here, like that is a one kind of retention tool in a way. If you think about games like League of Legends and World of Tanks, like there is so much happening in League of Legends that you are kind of constantly feeling that you are learning and learning and learning and learning. But the difficulty in here, especially from a retention point of view, is that the pros is obviously that you can reach this fabled skill mastery. Like, you can become really, really good at a game. And the feedback is typically like really, really, really good, and it's really rapid. But then the cons in there, from a kind of free-to-play point of view, is that it is potentially like slow to kind of onboard the player on this. So it takes a while to kind of understand the rules. The rules can actually be quite kind of, it might take a while to get on it. And with free-to-play, the problem is that the players don't have any kind of allegiance to your game. Like, when you first start up a free-to-play game, you could just like stop it on a second if you don't like something or if you don't understand something. So that's why these kind of very high-end skill mastery games can be really difficult on mobile environments, because it kind of needs that you kind of need to give it a few minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So it's difficult. And of course, once you reach the skill mastery, that's where the plateau happens. So you kind of get into this point where you feel that, well, actually, I'm so good at this game that there is no challenge for me anymore. It's just that this kind of nothing's happening. I'm just beating everyone. So good examples for that is like League of Legends and World of Tanks. So that's a good kind of like League of Legends, especially, is it's a full-on skill game, and you can just get better and better and better on it. So if skill mastery is such a really good thing, like it's been shown over and over in time that people get really hooked on games that require skill. Like, you see, like you've all heard of the StarCraft players in Korea. I mean, they're just like, it's a national sport there, so they are just really, really skilled at the game. So you would imagine that these kind of games would be a really, really good thing on mobile as well. Like, that's like a lot of people were kind of thinking that these multiplayer online battler games would be basically the thing that you want to break into. So the problem with those is that the platform and the gaming environment basically trump over the skill mastery element. So that's a screenshot from Solstice Arena, which came from Zynga. And this is, I know a few of the guys who did this, and they are all like massive League of Legends players. Like, they are at the like top ranks there, and they just thought that, well, I mean, we're going to do like a League of Legends style game on mobile, and that's just going to rock because it's going to be so good. Like, what can go wrong? Obviously, the problem with this is and I talked about this with the guys as well, but it's hard when you are kind of keen on doing League of Legends on mobile. Session lengths, they're pretty long. The matches are quite long. It's hard to kind of play this game anywhere else except sitting at your home on a desk and knowing that no one's going to disrupt you. Like, go to the London subway and have a game of Solstice Arena. Let's see how that goes. You can't play it anywhere. It also requires an internet connection all the time. So basically what the guys did, they basically did a PC game or a console game on a mobile, which is kind of wrong. You should do a mobile game that respects the mobile environment and the way people play these games. So that's a kind of good kind of point, that really good execution on the game. It looks really beautiful. The characters are really, really cool. But it's just the wrong game for the platform. And I didn't put the app and the graphs here, which show the downloads and crossing and all that stuff. But it's basically like this. So it's just like, there was an interest in the beginning, and then it all waned, and no one's playing it because it's just... It doesn't kind of, you can't play it where you typically use your mobile devices. So it is kind of like, if you make a game that demands that, hey, you have to give me your attention for 20 minutes and you need an online connection all the time, you are really cramping the kind of usability. You will kind of have other games that kind of overlap that possible hobby. And anyway, like, if you have the time to spend on it, you might as well go on PC and play Dota or League of Legends. It's a better experience because it's tailored for that platform. So kind of diving into the retention on like games nowadays. So skill mastery is one way to retain players. Like, you're so good in the game that you just come back to it over and over and over time. It's also good to remember that even if you aren't good in a game, like you feel that I'm just an average player, you can dynamically tweak the difficulty so that you kind of reach the flow state that it feels a bit difficult, but it's not too difficult. And it's easy enough, but it's not too easy. So the difficulty can kind of adapt to your play style and your defeats and such. So you can certainly cater to different style of players in games like skill games. But there's other ways to kind of retain the players and kind of get them come back to it. So one of the really kind of traditional ones is and this is something that the Insomniac Games guys coined, so the fantasy of the familiar. And this is like one of the things that I really like. So fantasy of the familiar is kind of two things. So there is a familiar premise and a pre-existing fantasy. So the premise is that you kind of know the subject already. Like, if you have a game and it's about something, the subject is familiar, so you kind of have an idea. So you kind of know what that entails. And the pre-existing fantasy is something that kind of, over time, it kind of changes, but that's in the kind of national psyche of the whole, like, people, like, especially in Western countries, is that this could be that the pre-existing fantasy could be that a jet fighter pilot or a fireman or a special forces guy or something. So it's kind of, some of those professions go away over time and some new ones appear. Like, if I say, like, reality TV star, like 20 years ago, that wouldn't have really meant anything. But nowadays, there are people who want to be reality television stars. So it is like, and everyone here has an idea what that probably entails. So that's kind of like the thing. And of course, the important bit here is that when you are thinking about what kind of a game you are making, fantasy of the familiar is something that you can really utilize to kind of, well, I just actually talked about it, but fireman is a good example of it, and I've actually used it before. So when I say fireman, all of you guys probably have an idea what firemen do. So when I do a game about firemen, the onboarding becomes really easy because every one of you probably have a pretty good idea what the game is going to be about. So I don't actually have to explain too much about the game because you kind of expect that, well, I'm probably putting out fires. And this has nothing to do with what it actually is in reality. There was a really good show on GDC last year from, I think it was the guys who did Spec Ops The Line, which was this, like, you're the special forces operatives and you're working on behind the, like, enemy lines in Dubai or something like that. And they obviously work with a lot of, like, real special forces guys. And incidentally, all of these special forces guys have the same name. It's John, and that's basically their alias because they can't give you their real names. And they were basically their fantasy of the familiar guardians. So when you do a game about special forces, every one of you guys have an idea like what the special forces guy does. So it's the guy who goes out there guns blazing and rescues the girl and all that stuff, and they just do this, like they crash through windows all the time and rappel down the building sites and all that stuff. That's the fantasy of the familiar of being a special forces operative. But then these Johns obviously tell you like how it's really like. Like basically if you would have to draw a picture of a special forces operative on what he does most of the time. He sits on a computer, works on a PowerPoint slide deck because he's trying to get his operation approved. And that he does over and over and over and over again. And one of the most common lines for those guys who actually served in Afghanistan and all that stuff, like when you're sitting in the ditch for 3 hours straight and that's your job because you're on a recon, a lot of the guys actually said that, oh fuck, I just wish I was back in base playing Call of Duty because the reality isn't always that fun. So, but that's not what the audience knows, because for the audience, Special Forces is always whatever happens in Zero Dark 30 or all these like Bravo 2-0 and all these like action bits. So, this is something that this is why some of the Facebook games are so popular, that you are kind of tapping into an element that a lot of people like to do. So, if you have a fantasy that you want to be a fireman, then the next best thing is to play those games. Or if you have a fantasy that you want to run a hospital or run a hotel or something like that, then that's a really good kind of way to do it. And one of the best ones is obviously like stuff like Farmville, because that just taps into so many things. Like everyone wants to have a bit of calm in their life, and you just want to grow stuff and everything's green and blossoming and all that, so it's very easy to understand like where that want comes from. So then one of the kind of new ones is that this is something that's kind of appearing, is something I worked for a year and a half. So you might have seen this before, but I'll just show the video on it. Autoplay. So, Clumsy Ninja was a kind of long time coming from Natural Motion, and obviously all of the animation there, all what you see that ninja do, that's basically behavioral animation from the Euphoria engine that Natural Motion was doing for years and years and years and years. So, you can basically grab the guy by the hand, and he acts accordingly and all that stuff. It's just the first step online. But I'm willing to bet that that will become really big in the future. Like you basically have these characters who try to behave in a very natural fashion, and you don't need to do keyframe animations like all the time there. So one thing that happened with that is definitely like the emotional attachment. So we already saw it like years ago when the project started that it's gonna be really big with kids. Like there was actually Miguel, who's the lead character artist, seriously, he actually said it a couple of days ago that like Clumsy Ninja is the best nanny, because if you're doing food, you just launch Clumsy Ninja, you give it to your kid, and I will guarantee it will satisfy him for like 15 to 20 minutes, because he just keeps torturing the poor old ninja, or just grabbing his legs and whatever, or giving him a trampoline to train. And that started coming through a lot on the at Natural Motion as well, because we started getting like tons of fan drawings and fan feedback and all kinds of stuff. Like people were sculpting the ninja out of whatever, or doing the drawings, or just like doing a massive amount of stuff. So it really kind of resonated with people. And it's not that the game is like massively gamey. There's hardly any gaming in it at all. It is mostly a kind of this kind of weird lifestyle tool in a way. But it is the, especially kids are really keen on to kind of see like what's the ninja up to. Every now and then you get push notifications that, hey, like I'm in a bit of a trouble in here. And then when you return to Clumsy Ninja, you realize that the guy's built a stack of boxes and he's on top of it and can't get down because he's afraid of heights. So all this kind of like, it's almost like a Tamagotchi, even though that wasn't our kind of what we were going for. But there is this feeling that it is kind of like a Tamagotchi that is actually really, really alive. So even though it is just the first step on for Clumsy Ninja and that IP, I'm kind of expecting, especially as the hardware increases, that it's going to be really, really big. And that's basically, it's a good way to show like what Natural Motion was really good at. So they basically, their kind of creed in life was that they do stuff that is impossible. And that's definitely what it was. It was a really, really difficult project. And this retained people really, really well. So when we looked at like some of the figures out there, it was just unprecedented like how people were kind of returning back to the game. And obviously, it is like one of the issues with the game is that it is a bit of a content churn game. So it will run out of content at some point, and then you have to do more. And that's a bit of a development trap. But obviously, the key in Clumsy Ninja is that make it into a kind of like a toy box game that you can create. You can bring in objects and other toys that basically create emergent behavior out of the character. So you never, like, if you put a cannon there and stick the guy in there, you don't know how he's going to fly out of it or what he's going to collide in with and how's that's going to look like. So that is, it is basically this living toy. So another example on the retention stuff is strategy games, because these are typically notoriously difficult in retaining players over the coveted 7-day period. So I think one of the best ones that basically cleaned the whole table is Game of War from Massive Zone. And this is basically a 24-hour-7 fantasy strategy MMO game, which basically just has it all. Well, it doesn't have it all, but it almost has it all. So you are building your own kind of city, all the buildings there, castles, all that stuff, upgrading them. You research new buildings, new troops. There's loads of troops there. You train them. You have a big, big, big world map with a lot of other players in there. You can send armies out there. You see them move in real time in the map, so you are seeing like everything happening there at once. It has all kinds of like global alliance one-to-one chats. One of the most interesting features there is the translation stuff. So they reward players for translating for them. So that means that even if you have an alliance that is full of like French and German and whatever speakers, what they say in chat gets automatically translated by other players, and those players get rewarded for it. So it feels like that you are basically playing this kind of worldwide MMO where everyone speaks English, or is like a it is translated to your local language. And that's pretty cool. And the guys spend a long time like working on it. So Game of War originally came from the kind of realization at Machine Zone that the guys used to do very cheap, very kind of poorly executed Mafia Wars clones. And then when CSR Racing and other, like, where basically when the market leaped in quality, they basically realized that, okay, so the game's up. We can't do these Mafia Wars, like, really, really super cheap games anymore because the expectation is different. And then they basically took everything they learned and all the analytics and metrics they got from those Mafia War games and just poured about 3 years into doing Game of War. And that's where it basically came out. So what makes it actually different? So the retention mechanics are interesting because I'm just going to concentrate on the first like four ones. There's a lot of other stuff there as well, but I'm not going to go into those. So the retention is interesting because when you start the game, one of the first actions you ever do is you will join an alliance there because they make it worthwhile. It's really easy to join an alliance, but within the first 5 minutes, you will end up with a group of people. Sorry.
So is it mobile?
It is mobile, yeah. So you more or less end up in the end up in an alliance, and the whole user experience on that is really well built, so it feels that I really want to be in the alliance, and you start seeing the benefits right off the bat. So how it deals with retention is that, well, you get into an alliance, and one of the things it does is when you build buildings in it, obviously it takes time to build buildings, but if any of those time durations is 5 minutes or under, you can actually finish it right on the spot there. You can just finish it with a button press. So one of the things it does is that now you are in this builder phase, so you have your city, and then you realize that I can actually build like a crap load of stuff and always finish it. So it's not actually taking any time. You can just you will probably end up building at least 30 buildings and upgrades, and it just happens instantly. So you kind of feel that, holy shit, my town is growing like really, really fast. Then finally you get to a point where the buildings actually take a bit longer, so it takes more than 5 minutes. So that's where the timer appears. So now it's now you have to wait a few seconds, then it drops under 5 minutes, and now you can finish it again. And that kind of ramps up slowly. And then finally you get to a point where it's like where you have to wait like 10 minutes. So in reality you have to wait 5 minutes to get your free press. If you go out of the game, then obviously you need to wait 10 minutes, or that's a kind of marker for you to come back. But in this point, the alliance steps in. So when you have a building that's being built, you can send a request to your alliance guys, and if they respond, they will shorten the period. So now I have my granary level 6 being built, and it takes 20 minutes. I ask my alliance for help. They reply, and you see the time diminished down to almost 5 minutes. So now it's instant again. So now it's finished. So now you kind of move from your solo play into the alliance bit. So everyone in the alliance is helping everyone build stuff. And depending on your stronghold level, the alliance can help you like build faster and faster. So then you get into the kind of really meaty alliance play stuff. So it's hard to do right. But for example, one of the things is gifting within the alliances. So when anyone in your alliance buys an in-app purchase, everyone in the alliance gets a secret gift. They won't tell, like, I think you can actually say in the chat if you did the IAP purchase, but it's not automatically outed because, well, here's the thing, like, if you use IAPs, then you are cheating in a way. So, but when you don't say who actually was the person who, well, maybe it was you, like you spent IAPs, so all of these guys here now get a free gift. So suddenly all these guys don't care that someone was spending on IAPs because it massively benefited them. So you are getting this massive advantage from others like spending money in the game. Then on top of that, there's randomly generated timed gifts. And that's also something that, remember that at, like when you are playing all the time, you will have buildings under construction, so you have the timers there, so you kind of know that, okay, so in 30 minutes it's going to be ready, so I can kind of close my phone and then come back. But on top of that, the picture is a bit bad, but there's basically this, you have this chest here that has a timer on it. So the timer can vary from anything between 5 minutes to 6 days, and it has a personal gift for you. And the tricky thing here that Machine Zone have done is that that gift is based on your play style. So if you are a really kind of aggressive player in the game, it could be that the gift actually gives you something that help you, that helps you build your village faster, because their thinking is that if you are just attacking everyone, you probably need a bit of help with your village because it's kind of going down there. So now you get a gift that helps you with the village, and then you feel, holy shit, that's a really good, I really use that. If you don't attack that much, then maybe it gives you an attack bonus or something. But the key thing here is that essentially it gives you a timer which tells you when you are going to receive a gift. So if it's 5 minutes, then, well, I might as well stick around with the game. Or if it's a day, then it's, well, I'll come back tomorrow. So it all kind of contributes to the retention. VIP login streaks, so this is basically something where you come back to the game every day, and every day you get an increasing bonus, so your grain production goes up by 10%, and that all remains as long as you kind of keep coming back to the game. So they call it the VIP level. So if I'm back on day 14, I'm VIP level 14 and now I have like a massive benefit in the game. But let's say you skip one day of playing, you lose all of that bonus, and then when you come back, it's just, well, I mean, hey, you just went somewhere and I'm sorry, but you don't have your VIP bonus anymore. So you can still play for 14 days straight and get that bonus back, or you can actually spend a few gems, so we'll return you back to the bonus level you were on. So it's a monetization mechanic as well. But now there's a lot of things now contributing to the whole retention of this game. Like, you have your alliance, which is really helpful, and you don't want to let those guys down. You have all these like gifts coming in and timed events. Your army's going to be reach the enemy base at 30 minutes or whatever. So you have a lot of things to kind of keep in mind, a lot of things and reasons to come back to the game. So it's really kind of taking that advantage. And the thing with, like, if you forget about all of this stuff for a while, it is a massive game. I would actually say that it is probably one of the most involved strategic and tactical games out there at the moment. Like, EVE Online is a really good example of a game that's kind of going 24/7, and everyone who plays it keeps in touch regularly, and you can do stuff on your mobile that helps your EVE character. But this is almost similar to that, because here you have a game you can access from anywhere. You get even a 3G signal, and all of these alliances are constantly at work. So you can be at work and you get a, can get a push notification from Game of War about your alliance doing this or that, so you can immediately respond. So if you think about these hardcore strategy games on PC, their hindrance is that you either sit on the PC for 24/7 and play it and do nothing else. But in here, you have an equivalent strategy game on your pocket, which is available everywhere. So it can't get more involved than that. And already, like, when the game launched, I was on it on the first few hours, and you could already see, like, one of the, I joined one alliance, you could already see the sheming going on. A lot of people talking in the chat about, okay, we're one of the first players here, we have to do this, 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 and this. You do this, you do this, you do this. And I returned to the game, like, 2 months later, because I don't have time for this. And I went through, I had, like, 350 messages or something from the like clan leaders or whatever, and then I realized that, okay, so it looks like I've been kicked from the clan or the alliance because I'm not obviously contributing. But I just for shits and giggles, I went through some of the messages there, like what's been going on, and there was like massive amount of like strategy being talked there. Like I found out that the alliance had actually shifted, like the whole, like, because it's a big world with a lot of cities, a lot of, like, you can have like, all of you guys could be living in the same area, each having your own city, and you are basically this massive hub that is just dominating this one area. So all of those guys, on a single vote, decided that this is too dangerous an area, there's an alliance that is bigger than us really close by, so we're gonna move. So they've basically taken all of their cities and just like ran across the world and just planted themselves somewhere else, where the geopolitics of Game of War weren't as harsh. So that is pretty amazing to me, and it is just a mobile game. And another thing is that, which is also crucial, is that when it comes to the 7-day retention and all of that stuff, and because you end up in an alliance very early on in the game, what the game is basically telling you is that you're not actually giving your allegiance to the game, but you are giving your allegiance to the alliance. So very early on in the game, it actually tells you that, hey, just like forget about the game. Like you don't have to like you don't have to come back for me. But what it is telling you is that you want to come back to your alliance, because those guys from the get-go, they are helping you massively, and it is very kind of mutual things. Like you don't want to let your friends down. So that's a really key kind of retainer. And that is, to a degree, that's happening with Clash of Clans as well. Like, a lot of people there don't care about the kind of super massive high score battle that happens in the top three, but they really enjoy being in the kind of clan with a lot of friends there, and especially the fact that they have the high score and who donates how many troops. Even if you don't play actively, you can still feel that you are part of the kind of alliance, and you are part of kind of giving help to people by being the guy who week after week donates the most troops out there. So even if you don't have time to play, you can still donate troops to other people and feel part of the clan. So that kind of playing with other people, that's a really good retainer. And it's not a new thing that happened with World of Warcraft back in the day. Like, I remember, like, back when World of Warcraft launched, when the game actually was pretty hard, like, some of those raids lasted like 8 hours. And then if you play with American guys, you realize that, okay, so it's now 10 p.m. and we just started the raid. And then 6 a.m., you kind of, oh, man, like, when is this raid ending? Like, we still have a couple of bosses to take down. So that is, like, you don't, like, you are probably in a really crucial kind of position in the game. And you can't just tell the guys that, hey, guys, I'm a bit sleepy, so I'm going to just take off. Because it might mean that now the raid is missing one crucial guy, and that's going to screw it up for 39 other people. One of my best memories from World of Warcraft is that, like, we did this one huge raid, and I was so sleep deprivated in the end that when we got to the final, it was like just like there was a boss, and then there was its bodyguard boss, and we were supposed to take the bodyguard out first so that then the boss is easier to handle. Like, I started nodding off in front of the computer, like, really, really badly, and then I realized I was like this, and then I lift up like this, and then I find my character running against the pillar on the castle just because I had my, like, just hand laying on the keyboard. And then I look left and I see everyone else in the guild taking out the bodyguard. And to my right, if I would have moved like 1 meter and ran there, there would have been the end boss of the raid. And if I would have ran there, it means that the boss would have come and attacked the raid and taken everyone out, and none of those guys would have realized what had happened. So it's a really kind of crucial part to stay awake, because you don't want to let your other raid be kind of ambushed there. But that was kind of one of those moments when I kind of thought that, yeah, okay, maybe I played in of World of Warcraft for a while. Nowadays it's a lot easier because they actually think about the time it takes to play, and you can actually choose how long and how easy and all that stuff. But back in the day, some of the biggest raids were like 8 hour affairs, so it was pretty harsh. And yeah, going on with Game of War a bit, it does a really good power ranking stuff, so this kind of contributes to the retention a bit as well. So it caters to all player types. So there's the battle scheme of like killers and achievers and socializers and so on. So you can do the test online to find out like who are you. But it basically caters to all of this. So if you're a killer type person, which basically means that you really enjoy conflict and you want to win all the time, well, it's the game for you. Just build up your army and raid those villages. If you're an achiever, it kind of means that you kind of want to do all the quests. You want to do like 100% on anything. It caters to you really well. If you're a socializer, there's the alliance, chat, full-on translations. You can just chat away as much as you can. And it just caters to all of those. It has a rank. Go for it. There is four. There's killers, achievers, socializers, and explorers. So, just covering that one, explorer is basically someone who is just really curious. If you have a world that has a story in it, they will go through that story, they will read the history. If you have a map you can explore, they will explore it. So every single player out there has these traits. So it's typically, if you do the battle test online, it basically divides it up. So it asks you questions, and then it basically says that, okay, you're a 30% killer, 15% socializer, and so on and so on and so on. Yeah, I mean, it was originally built for MMOs, but it's a good way to kind of, and it's good to think like it's, if you kind of think about player types, it is good to have everything, like all of those in your game. Like, you have something for the ones that really are keen on winning and in the conflict, and then you have something for the ones that want to be masters at everything and they want to complete everything for the achievers. So it's a really good one to do.
Does that apply to all games?
Definitely. It doesn't apply to all, like, well, yeah, you should have it in all games, but it applies to all players, because I've had some discussions when we talk about battle that someone just says that, well, I'm not actually any one of those. And that's kind of weird, because it's like, so what kind of games do you actually play? Because it's kind of, you are basically saying that, well, I don't actually like games at all. But it's worth it. You can just Google battle test. and that's where you find it. It has a dynamic ranking system that reflects multiple strengths, and it has a really fair distribution of power as well. So whatever your playing behavior is, the game will reward that. So if you don't want to fight, you can find many other ways of being useful, be recognized for that. You can be the master builder and master tactician in the game without, and you can just like, you can basically earn your dues. And that also actually harks back to MMOs. So I used to play Dark Age of Camelot back in the day on a role-playing server, because I used to be really big on role-playing. So, which basically means that you don't power game at all. You don't want to be the best, but you want to stay in character. And we were playing these big troll characters there. And for some reason or another on this role-playing server, there were these clans that were actually the top player versus player clans in the whole game. So when you look at like these kind of esports like athletes who are really good at a certain game and they're really good at doing this conflict, this was the equivalent in Dark Age of Camelot. So we actually had like basically the best of the best player versus player players on that server. But Dark Age of Camelot had a crafting system that was really like intense. So you can basically craft armor and weapons and all that stuff. And that's the best gear you can ever get in the game. You can play the single player, or you can play the quests in the game, but that will never give you as good gear as handcrafted stuff does. Now the problem with the crafting is that at the top end, like when you are a really good like swordsmith, for example, you do like the best swords in the game. One sword takes about 20 to 30 minutes to craft. And obviously in this like Dark Age of Camelot, you couldn't speed this up. And when you're a top of the line swordsmith, it means that every 20 to 30 minutes you create this sword and it has a quality rating. And typically on that level, it means that the quality is about 98-99%. And that directly contributes to the damage the sword does, especially when you enchant it. Every sword, like 1 out of 50, would end up being like 100% quality sword. So that's a masterpiece. But if you think about it, like 1 sword out of 50, so 50 swords times 30 minutes, it takes a while to craft these things. So actually the clan I was in, which was just role-playing clan, we happened to be the best crafters in the server. So we were actually the merchants of death for these player versus player guys, because they had no time to learn crafting in game. They just wanted to battle other players. They always came to us to get their weapons because we did the best weapons out there. So that's a good kind of, you can feel that you are really essentially contributing to the life in these servers without ever taking part in the actual like PvP games or whatever. So it's important, like if you can be, you want to feel that you are useful in all these games, depending on like what you can do there. So definitely to kind of start summing the retention part up is that good mobile games are about retention. It's something that the player wants and has a reason to return to, and the game is playable on whatever circumstances the device is typically used in. And the last line is something that a lot of developers just they just don't take it. They do League of Legends on mobile, or they do, well, you basically do like a console game on a mobile, and that's wrong, because that's not how it rolls, because you play console games on a console games. So don't go and create a console experience on mobile devices, but create a console quality mobile experience. And that's what Natural Motion does. So it does like really, really good looking games, but it does it on the mobile kind of what the platform is meant for. So to kind of really sum it up, If you do a game on mobile, you should take all of those three things into account. So you might be sitting in the London subway or a toilet or a bus or airfield and you have like 2 minutes to spend. Or actually the Natural Motion classic was that the Starbucks test. So when you walk out in Oxford and you go to the Starbucks or Costa or whatever coffee shop, the time it takes for you to queue up and get your latte or whatever your poison is, that's where you should have like a meaningful gameplay session in a game. So that was the test. It's not like written in stone, but that was the test basically. But on the other hand, this doesn't mean that you have to do these really minuscule games. you really want to do games where you can spend 2 hours on, because that means that you can actually engage with it every time. So with Game of War, it might mean that I just take my mobile here, I put some buildings being constructed, and then I just quit. And then later in the evening, when I have a bit free time, I'm actually thinking, like, so where should I attack? And what should I do with the Alliance? And what are the messages I'm getting from the Alliance? And that's when the monetization gets easier. So when people kind of come back to your game, they are more keen on spending money on it if you give them the chance to spend it. And I'm quoting Thorsten here a bit, because and kind of jumping into customer acquisition bit as well, because this is what Thorsten was always saying, that the quality is the ultimate customer equation tool. So what he means in this is that's Juan Pablo Montoya on, like, what is it? He's like a Formula driver or something. So he was being interviewed in the, like, I don't know, he was driving tests or something, and he was being... he was being interviewed on television about, like, his, like, so how did the drive, like, how did the races go, and blah blah blah. And the guy was playing CSR Racing on iPad, and he was just like, yeah. And then the, like, interviewer goes, like, so what do you have there? And then, oh, it's CSR Racing. Look at, like, all these cars. And here we have, like, Natural Motion getting, like, 10 minutes worth of free publicity on Formula Ones, essentially. And that was, the guy basically demoed our games. He showed all of his garage, all the cars he's got. And then he even went to the game, like, let me show how it is. And then he did, I think he took, like, one of the, what was it called? Well, there's a race there where you can decide, like, which difficulty you want to play it in. And he actually took, like, I don't know, it's like easy or medium, and then he tried to kind of hide it. And then the interviewer said, oh, what, you're selecting like an easy race? So what's that, like, you're a Formula One driver and you're taking like an easy race? And then he starts playing it and all that. But it's like, when you have a really high-end product that looks really cool, the customer acquisition cost will be really low, because stuff like CSR Racing and the games Natural Motion did, like, it was easy to kind of, you can sit on the subway, you see a guy play a really cool looking game, it takes a few seconds to kind of get the fantasy of the familiar, because, oh, it's a racing game, and, oh, is that a real Audi, so what's the game called? So that's your customer acquisition in a very, very viral sense. You get the game when you glance at it, you get the name, you download it, or then you see stuff like this happen. So that's, on the mobile space, that's really important. So that's maybe on, any questions on kind of like what I've been covering on the retention bit? Go for it. So were we able to actually basically notice the spike of this, like the spike effect on the graphs? I can't actually remember, because I think this was really early days on the CSR Racing, and it was actually doing really, really well. And it was actually that was the game. It did like $12 million a month, and that was the game that basically, it told a lot of people, especially in the UK, that you can actually do a console quality game on mobile and it's not gonna, like, necessarily fail. Like, you don't have to do like 2D games, or you don't have to do like this. You can push the quality. So this was kind of the tail end of that early kind of spike. And obviously Clash of Clans was released on that same summer. I think it came on August, and CSR Racing launched in June. So obviously CSR was kind of overshadowed by Clash of Clans a bit, but it still continues to do really, really well. So jumping a bit on the monetization stuff. So I'm going to look a few popular games here. So obviously monetization, it's a result of a really good core loop, great retention, social mechanics, and overall having a really great product. And when it comes to monetization, it's definitely the value proposition that matters. So you probably have had guys here who've talked about like hard currency and soft currency and all that stuff. So I'm not going to go into that. It's the value proposition that matters. And when you like a game that you kind of keep on coming back to, you get that feeling that even if the game is kind of giving you opportunities to pay, you basically get this feeling that, well, I could actually spend a few, like, few bits and bobs here and there. And this doesn't mean that you become this kind of weird narcomatic, that you just have to spend like $200 on it. Like, you can get a really good deal if the value proposition is there by just spending a bit. One example is subway surfers or endless runners in general. So what those do is, they're really nice games. I really like playing them, but Subway Surfers is probably the best one. So one of the things it offers you as an in-app purchase is the fact that it doubles all the money you can get while you are playing the game. So if you play a lot of endless runners and you get to the game, it's a no-brainer purchase. So you get the game for free, you feel that I'm really enjoying this, it has a lot of characters, and it's really fun and it's really fast-paced. So I know I'm going to play this for a while, so I might as well give the developer something and buy the doubler. It's not the best monetization mechanic because it most likely means that that's the only time you are going to monetize a player, because it's like, unless you become like a super fan, that's probably the only thing you will spend on. So this is a kind of question of kind of what your target is. If you are a three-man studio and you are doing games like this, you will probably be really happy that anytime players monetize on your game, it's going to be this one single purchase that is available and makes the most sense. But it's unlikely that they will buy anything else. But for some, it's really good. And for some, they want uncapped monetization, so you can spend and spend and spend and spend and spend as much as you want. But yeah, it's a good value proposition. You are basically speeding up your gameplay and you are unlocking characters faster and so on and so on. So CSR Racing, it's an interesting example. So CSR Racing, I think it probably would have bombed quite heavily. Well, not necessarily, but it has real licensed cars. So on the get-go, it has Audis and BMW Minis, which are actually manufactured in Oxford, and all kinds. It doesn't have any Saabs, which just sucks. I've been requesting them ever since the game launched, but I don't know what's with that, but I mean, it should have a Saab. So in here, you can spend like hard currency to actually like own some of the cars, or you can just earn money and buy them, but some of the cars are just hard currency cars, so you probably have to spend, like, play a long, long, long time to earn enough hard currency to get them, or then you have to use real money to get enough gems or something to actually get the car. And the cars are restricted on a tier-by-tier basis, so there's 5 tiers in the game. For each tier, there's specific cars you can race. If you have a tier 1 car, you can't go to tier 2 and race with that. So it kind of feels that it's fairly limiting. Like, if I'm buying this Ferrari or whatever here, I can't actually race the Ladas on the first tier or whatever. But still, people do buy those cars. So, and of course, the question is, like, why do you buy these cars? Like, Juan Pablo Montoya probably has a lot of money, but he actually had bought pretty much all the cars. So our kind of hypothesis on this was, and which we kind of like to believe, and it kind of felt like when we were looking at the social media, Twitter stuff, is that because we kind of aim to do the cars as high quality as possible and make the experience really slick. So we are like, when you're not in the race, this is what you're most likely to see. You're in your garage, it's really nice and lit. You can swipe the screen, you can zoom into your car, and it kind of feels that it's there. And we were kind of trying to get this feeling that if owning a real car or a real Chevrolet or whatever, it's 100%, then we were trying to make you feel that at least owning it in CSR Racing is 5% of that feeling. And that's actually a similar thing that happens in like Forza Motorsports on Xbox 360 and stuff. It's a bit of a car and pawn thing. So you kind of, I used to play Forza quite a lot, and obviously it has a lot of supercars, like hundreds and hundreds of cars, but I always drove around with the Saab, like Saab 9-3, like rocking it. It was like magnificent car. So I made my best to kind of make sure that whatever the race, I configured the car so that I could race with the Saab, because I just like those cars. So in here, one of the things happened that there's a feature in CSR Racing. It's not a very social game. You can't really share much. But what you can share is you can share your photograph you take of the car in Twitter. And that's kind of like, so why would you tweet a photo? But that's actually one of the things that gets tweeted like a massive amount. And people are just posting their photos of the car. And some of it has to be the fact that, hey, look at my car kind of thing. Like, this is kind of what I have, or this is what I would like to have in real life. But there is something there when you have that kind of connection. And later on, obviously, the guys have added a lot more cars, and there's competitions and stuff, and you can earn. You can get a pretty respectable garage by now. So yeah, that's CSR. Then on Game of War, it's a really kind of hard monetizer. So yeah, it does a lot, like multifaceted sales, bundles, time limited sales. So it is basically, and that kind of ties into the user behavior adapted sales. So depending on your playing style, it is actually giving you very customized things to buy that basically help you in your style of gaming. Then it has a lot of like conjoint analysis stuff baked into the kind of like how it presents the bundles. So that's kind of like the wine and steak thing, that you go to a restaurant and then you get your, if you buy a cheap steak, then you will most likely buy a slightly more expensive wine, because it's kind of like, I was pretty cheap on the steak, so I'm going to buy the like fancier wine. And that's they kind of want how they want you to think it. So it's kind of, it presents you these kind of different sales and different bundles. And a lot of they also do a lot of price anchoring stuff. So you see this $50 thing here. So I'm not gonna spend any money on that. But the thing next to it, that's actually looking pretty good. So you have this kind of price anchor thing, that this is like really expensive, and I'm never gonna buy that. But that makes me feel that the bundle next to it is actually really, really good deal, because like you're almost getting the same, but it's way, way cheaper. So that has to be really good. So they do a lot of this kind of stuff. And as when you're talking about these hardcore strategy games that have a lot of resources, a lot of resource generations, and just a lot of stuff going on, that's also a really good opportunity to kind of monetize as well. And they are basically, it's a game worth playing to kind of see what the, like if you think about doing like a massive multiplayer online strategy game, like it's hard to kind of top Game of War at the moment on feature side. Or the flip side is that it is a very confusing game as well. There's a lot of menus and all that stuff covered.
How do you feel about this core monetization? Do you like designing that kind of games, and does it drive too much the game design?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's something that's been kind of going on in Facebook for a couple of days, thanks to Petri, who's our head of studio. He kind of ramped up a bit of a discussion in Facebook with like 100 replies or something. I have a slide on it later on. Oh yeah, so the question is like, how do I feel about the game design and the monetization kind of tying into it, and that monetization driving the core loop and so on and so on. The main point is that at the end of the day, like one thing for me at least hasn't changed at all, is the fact that you have to do a fun game, and it has to be a fun core loop. A very small amount of players in mobile free-to-play gets monetized, so you are still like generating a lot of fun for like basically all the players there. And then if you really like the, like if you retain the player, then that's where you monetize him. So then it means that for that guy, the value proposition is there. Like, it makes sense. The tricky thing, especially in games like Game of War, is that you want to make it fair. So you kind of want to make it so that it's, if you have like matchmaking here and there, and if you have players who've kind of used in-app purchases, they get matchmaked together. Or like in Game of War, it's a they basically, like, the whole alliance thing works so that you can basically, I think the alliances are open-ended, so you can join whatever alliance if you want, unless as a kind of alliance leader, you have some kind of a barricade for it. But basically, as Game of War evolves and they go through those wars, smaller alliances get sucked into the kind of bigger ones. So there are always the sides fighting. Some of them are the guys who played for 24/7, some only this much. Those guys might use in-app purchases to speed up their progress so they are up with where the other players are. But essentially, it comes down to the kind of value proposition. And it doesn't really enter into the kind of, I wouldn't say it enters into the kind of core loop design that much. Like I was thinking, like at Natural Motion, like I was in on most of the like meetings when it came to projects, because I was the head of design there. And we didn't really talk about monetization that much. Like, it wasn't something that, how do we get the most money out of these guys? Like, Fana was the most important thing. Like, Thorsten was coming all the time there and kind of like, so it's, yeah, I mean, this needs to be different because it's not fun. Like, that's the main bit. And fun drives the retention. And then when you have like, it's rare nowadays that you kind of do this like first day monetization stuff. It was happening like back in the day, but nowadays you kind of need to retain the player and get him kind of used to it. And the whole market is kind of in a constant change as well in terms of like how players play this game. But I'll get back to that later. Another good example on this is this is from Halfbrick, the Colossatron. Massive world threat. So this is your typical game where, this is your game where your massive cyber dragon attacks big capital cities and lays them to waste. And it's a kind of like a weird automatic shoot 'em up game. So this is a good example of something that it's a really, really fun game. It's a paid game, so it's a bit different, but it's a bit weird why they did it so that it's just a kind of paid game. It takes 2 hours to complete. I did it on Christmas Eve or something like that. I just played it furiously and completed it. And it does monetize. It has like a couple of in-app purchases in it. So all of these weapons, so how the gameplay basically works is you have this dragon kind of automatically going around the city. All these weapons on the back of it are firing at targets and you're just trying to destroy the city. And on the air, you have these kind of hovering power pack things. And I can tap here and drag this onto my like Colossatron, and now suddenly it has the yellow weapon and it becomes active and starts shooting. So there's different colors there. Every day, your choice of weapon rotates automatically. So every 24 hours, the weapons change. So this day I had the yellow thing was a flamethrower, tomorrow it's a missile launcher. So you know, one monetization point is that if you really like the flamethrower, you can just buy it, and then it means that you can, if you so choose, you can always use it. But the weird thing was that I would really like to see how that monetizes, because it's really fun that the weapons are on rotation, that every 24 hours you get a new configuration and what's kind of going to happen. So it's a bit weird in its monetization. And then obviously in a game like this where the kind of content ends really fast, there really is no kind of end game there. You just get like more difficult levels. It throws in a few leaderboards there. But it really is like after 2 hours, you kind of feel that, well, I'm basically just finished with this game. And to be fair, the Halfbrick guys got my 99 cents on this. But I'm not sure if that is their driving strategy, because those are the guys who did like Fruit Ninja, which was like the numbers like second game after Angry Birds when it comes to this kind of just global kind of popularity. So if it's okay for you that your game makes kind of like a 99 cent profit from a player, then maybe it's okay. But it's good to remember that paid games get like a fraction of players that free-to-play stuff gets. So it's really hard when you are doing like paid games that you pay up front, but then you have in-app purchases as well. I think it's better to just, you do a paid game and you put a proper price on it. Or if you want to do like a 99 cent game, you just go free. I don't think like 99 cent is the kind of way to do it these days. And I think guys like Ocean, like who did Ocean Horn here in Helsinki, they're charging like what, €8 for Ocean Horn. So they are basically betting it that, hey, you pay this much money, you get a lot of quality. And that's a fair way to do it. I think Ocean Horn is probably the high end these days, what you can make with paid games. I think I'm amazed if it's anyone's gonna earn more than those guys, or just when it comes to that. So yeah, typically only the small proportion of your players will pay. And one of the things that's been discussed a lot is the whole whales thing. So you want to attract people who just spend $200 on your game, or $1,000, or like $6,000, or whatever, just the kind of ludicrous sums. And it's not, actually most of the games I worked for, they've never had any whales. So they've never had any people who actually go out of their way in spending. Like, it's just a purchase here, purchase there. And they've still been like massively profitable games and that continue to make really good money. So this is something that you kind of think about from a your perspective? Like, what do you want to do? Like, do you want to cap the monetization, or do you want to, like, how do you control the maximum spending games? And especially if you're doing games for children, like, there's all kinds of ethical concerns here, but you have to, like, every studio I've been in, they've always had these discussions, and it's always been, like, doing the right thing is the right thing to do. And then kind of going back to the, like, what you were kind of talking about, there was a really good one from the CEO of Game Analytics, and he was talking about this, that it's, for a developer these days, there is no average user, because, I mean, PC games, they're a specific market. Mobile games, the whole world. So the kind of cohorts are really different. The average users are just like, it's really hard to pinpoint, like, who is that guy? For some people, spending this amount of money means absolutely nothing. For some people, this is really important. One of the trends that's been going on for a couple of years is that if you have kids, then one of the Christmas presents that those kids receive might be a bundle of gems or whatever in their favorite free-to-play game, like Dragon Whale or whatever. That's really common nowadays. So you can kind of see where the, like, a few years from now, like, where the market's going to be, because you have these young players who are playing like this. So you have to kind of cater to everyone there. Let's briefly talk about metrics. I'm not a massive metrics guy, as I said, but I'll talk a few things. So obviously metrics give you, like, a lot. These are some metrics I obviously had to kind of erase all the relevant text there, so you have no idea what that actually means, but that's life. So obviously, like, the metrics tell you a lot. Like, you can see, like, all kinds of, like, if a guy is playing this game on an iPhone 5 and on an iPhone 4, why is it that the iPhone 4 players drop off during the first time user experience at this specific point? Maybe the game performance takes a hit there, and then the experience sucks, and then you drop off. You don't necessarily have to do just, like, game A/B tests. You can just check out, like, which button is the best, like green or blue. On CSR advertising, you could check, like, which cars work the best for American advertisement. So is it European cars or American cars? What about Asia when it comes to cars? Which cars they prefer to see on advertisement? You can just get all of this stuff. So it's really easy to kind of get the false sense that the kind of these metrics and analytics, they're just giving you all the answers there. And you can check, like, what difficulty balancing makes the player spend more or whatever, all of this stuff. But obviously, you can't design a game by metrics. So there is a kind of, I've seen a few cases where this has kind of happened, and it's basically you have an analytics guy who builds a framework in Excel, and he's not even part of the team that develops the game. So he's basically just coming into meetings asking, oh, what's the game about? Okay, this. And then he builds an Excel framework which kind of simulates the game, and then it just starts thinking, like, okay, well, I want this game to last 3 months. Then he inputs 3 months there. All the other fields are filled there, so this is how much experience you get from here, and this is when you level up, and blah, 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 blah. And it has nothing to do with the actual fun, or what makes the game fun, what feels fun, what's the right pacing for the game. And that's, so it's a, this is something that was a bit of a plague in San Francisco, and especially in Zynga at one point, that there was a really, like, I was trying to recruit game designers to the San Francisco office, and all the, like, guys there were, like, really, really weird, because they had this weird kind of analytics stint in a way that they, I don't know where did they lost it or did they have it at all, but there was this weird kind of feeling that they're just, like, they just do Excel, they don't do games. So it was, and yeah, it's still a bit of an issue there, but yeah. And obviously, like, design by metrics is, like, I'm not sure if you guys remember, but I think the chief user experience director at Google left, like, a few years ago. Obviously, he's probably been replaced, but he basically said that I can't work in a company where every single thing is designed by metrics. So he was talking about the shade of blue on a kind of like a user interface element, because they were A/B testing that. So you had, like, 20 different shades of blue, guys like this the most, so that's the blue. So you can drop all the artistic stuff or any kind of color theory or anything, you just can't just throw that away because the users decide that it's blue, or it's this shade of blue. But obviously there is good stuff in metrics if you do it kind of properly. So one good way to do it is that, or just how you use Excel in a way, that one good way to do it is that you get game designers to hone in on the kind of what's a good feeling for a game, how does it kind of, what's the good pace, like when do I get like my level ups and whatever. And then from that experience, if you have like massive Excel gurus out there, they can essentially build it and just extrapolate on that, like just like further into the game, that if that's the experience you want, then this is the basing for the rest of the game. And just like, so you can like, there's a lot of companies that take this kind of balancing straight out of the Excel, and they just build like really big models on like how it kind of works. Because it used to be like, it was a really crap job to do like balancing a game. You were fiddling like single numbers here, which had no kind of connections, but like Excel helps in that if you change this value, then this happens. This is an old Excel of mine, like back in the day from a game called Island God. I'm gonna come back to it at some point, but it was a massive clusterfuck. I never wanna kind of think about it, but it's a good example of how to do things wrong. I just used the screenshot here, but this was, I basically built the game in Excel, and it was running in Excel, and I could change like this guy's doing this and this guy's doing this, and that's how much resources I'm getting. What did I just say about like doing a game on Excel? So yeah, okay. So. Metrics won't replace a good product. They don't replace the creativity, art, design. They won't replace the qualitative metrics, such as if the game is running really shit on iPhone 4, then there's no metric in the world that can save you, or the analytics will just tell you that, well, I mean, we see that these guys are dropping off, but could be plenty of reason why it's kind of happening. But metrics are good for the kind of just tracking the kind of user lifetime stuff. So you have a guy who's interested in the game and he kind of signs up, you can have a metrics that track that, like where do they come from, blah, blah, blah. And then you have a, like your trial beta user guy, and then you can track metrics that invoke the usage, like how is he actually getting kind of engaged as a customer. And then you can use like look at metrics that generate the kind of engagement. And then a conversion into a paying player, so he becomes a passionate customer. So you can kind of track like what are the things that flip the switch at every one of these stages. So the thing with metrics is that you get the data instantly, but what's the road to these analytics and metrics? So in order to run a successful analytics on those metrics, first of all, like you need a good amount of players to eliminate the statistical noise. It's all statistics. So that can take a while, especially if you don't want to actually get attention to your game. So let's say you're soft launching there, you don't spend any of the money on like user acquisition or anything, because you just want to see like does it like get off virally. So it can take a while to get the like 10,000 players or 100,000 players on it to get kind of valid data. But the timeline for those tests is actually like surprisingly long. It obviously varies from company to company, but you have to design the test. What's your hypothesis? What are you actually trying to look for? You have to design the A/B buckets. So what are the things we are kind of testing here? You probably need a QA period for that test, like is it actually working? Then you need to submit that or do like a server-side submission. You need to get the players, then you need to get the data, then you need to analyze the data. So it actually can be like a pretty long, like it can take a week or two to even go through like a round like this. So one of the pet kind of phrases in the industry, and it's a bit of a joke in a way, is that you kind of, if you have a hard decision to make, we can always A/B test it, so it's not my problem. We can always A/B test it, so we can always see like what the guys like and what they don't. So, and then a month later you have another feature, and I'm not sure about this. Well, we can always A/B test it. So then when the game is out there, you have a list like this long of all the A/B tests that you are. I really want to see data on all of these points. And it's just like a massive amount. And then even if it takes a week to get through like a few of those tests, and you are doing like content updates all the time, then that list is just like, there's so many tests you could be doing, but not all of them are the ones that you really, really need to do. But it's a kind of, you have to rely on your gut instinct, and you have to kind of be true to the game to kind of just make the calls here and there. And don't outsource your game into being this massive super test that you are just like, I want to know if he really likes our team on this game. So Metrics are force multiplier, so don't be a slave to them. They are really good, but just don't be a slave to them. So then on the kind of really important advice on how to make shit game. Everyone always gives you like good advice on how to make good games, so I'm going to give you like really bad advice. So, and especially with good games, it's basically like big or small set, like more money, more problems. So it's much exciting to do a shit game. Well, not really. It's how to make your project more difficult and possibly result in a shit game. So how to make the experience kind of suck. So one guy, this has been my kind of guiding principle in game development world, is that you don't want to spend years of your life working on a shit game. Like, I know guys who've worked on like 5 years on a really, really bad project, and then it ends cancelled, or it doesn't make, it wasn't satisfying to do it, and then the end result isn't satisfying. And what is it like? You could be spending your 5 years doing something a lot more better. So I think it's, and obviously it's not for everyone, but it's kind of, I think it's important that you work with people and you work with projects that you are truly kind of interested in, because it's hard work. It's really hard to work on a kind of creative industry. It's long hours, all that stuff, so it's not the easiest job to be in. So you really want to be in it for the game instead of in it for the money or any of that stuff. So it needs to be a good experience. So, and as a kind of anecdote, hopefully it has changed, but the average time a person spends in the game industry is 5 years. I think it's kind of skewed for USA because they've had a bit of a hard time there. But it's the constant change and bad projects and all that bad project management. Like it created a bit of a churn, but I think it's a lot better in Europe and especially in Finland. So first thing, forget about the core loop. So I mean, it'll come. Like we can just create. Like we can do the core loop whenever. So I mean, it's a, like this. This is one very famous core loop. So you collect underpants, then you, and then you get profit. So that's a kind of like, yeah, okay, it's there. So who recognized the guys in the middle? Someone answer. Yeah, but who are they? Well said. I have a prize for you. Hopefully it doesn't break. It's due. Yeah, okay. I'm going to smack it in your head. You take a pass. I'm traveling between UK and Finland so much that I always have to bring jelly beans to the guys at the office, so I had one bag just for this. Yeah, underpant gnomes, the ultimate core loop. Another one, forget the core pillars. This is something that's, this has been kind of on and off waning. Like, what is important? It's, sometimes it's important, sometimes it's not. But this is something that really allows you and your team to kind of really nail down like what's important in the game. So every time you have a really big decision to make, you look at the core pillars, and basically the core pillars should answer like what is the right way to do it. Because this is something that, especially with natural motion, we could spend like 2 weeks in the beginning of a project to just nail down. And you can do this different ways, but basically each single word needs to be like really well put down, and everyone in the team has to have the same idea of what that word actually means. So this is actually some of the, well, it's not actually, there's a few of those are from Farmville too, but basically like you basically want these core pillars that kind of really like emphasize like this is what the game is about. So when it comes to everything needs to level up or something, or feel part of the community, then what are the each, if these are the core pillars, then how do these different disciplines in the team contribute to this? So what can game designers do to make sure that everything levels up? What can artists do to make sure that everything levels up? What can programmers do to help on that? So some of it is really easy. So on everything needs to level up, so it kind of implies that everything just needs to grow and change and grow and change and just become bigger and bigger and bigger. But yeah, these are important to nail down, because otherwise what happens is that all your team members will have a different idea of the game they are making, because it's not nailed down. And the core pillars are especially really, really good. Like when you get two new team members, you can just do like, you can laminate a piece of paper with the core pillars, maybe the backstory of the game, and then you walk through the guy, like just these are the things that matter in this game, and these are the really important bits. So I have the kind of graphics background, so I draw a lot. So most of my game design stuff kind of revolves around illustrations and stuff like that, that kind of shows that this is what we are kind of making, and this is what I want. One of the big parts of being a game designer is that you are kind of evangelizing your design, and kind of like, this is the intention and let's stick to this road. Then a really, really good one is to just, hey, why don't you just do all games when you're actually making one? So Island Guard was a project in Digital Chocolate we did in like 2010 or something like that. And it was greenlit on a meeting where 12 people voted yes on a tribe on a deserted island game. And everyone probably had a different idea what that actually means. Somehow, I can't remember at what point, but God was involved. So it became Island God. I think there game at one point, it was kind of like Populous. So you are kind of playing this God, and you have these minions. But it's also a resource management game, as in Facebook. And it was kind of like a survival game as well. There was a bit of MacGyverism involved. So you actually had these bits and pieces that you could collect, and then you could craft something useful out of it. Yeah, it was a bit of a survival game, so you needed food for your tribe and all that stuff. So it was this mishmash of stuff that didn't really focus on anything specific. So you could use godly powers, you could zap your guy and just play around with them and take them and toss them and all that stuff. But at the same time, you were also managing your tribe members and trying to build something here. So it was kind of whack in terms of like what the perspective here is. So that was my fault. Like that was a kind of good experience. And interesting enough, there's other companies out there who actually done similar games in the, like after us. One of them was released like a year ago, and they all seem to suffer on the same thing. Like it's hard to get to the core of a game like this. I don't know why is it, but these are really challenging games to make so that it kind of becomes fun. And then one of the really bad things is that all your future updates in the game require like heavy content. So this was kind of like the learning period for a lot of guys in Digital Chocolate. But what we did in Island Guard is that we created this storyline where you need to build a boat. You can see the boat there. And it takes a lot of resources and wood. And it, day by day, it slowly grows and grows and grows. And then it becomes a boat. And then you decide, like, okay, I'm going to send these two guys on a boat because we just got this bottled message that our prophet or some kind of wise guru guys actually tsunami swept him on a different island or something, and we need to go and pick him up, so we need a boat. So that's your kind of cause here. And then you put the guys on a boat, they go off. 2 weeks later, in real time, they probably come back and you get like one additional tribe member who is this kind of Jesus-looking guy. But the development of that was like massive. Like you have all these kind of, obviously there's the graphical assets and the new character, but just the logic for the like all of this stuff and user experience, which anyway ended up being a content that a kind of average player probably goes through in about 3 weeks or so, 3 or 4 weeks. So it's kind of like, what are you putting your effort on? And how much is that gonna take versus what the benefit is? That has sunk many boats in the past. Like you just realized that, well, I can't actually keep up with the players. Like they will always bump into the content wall, after which there is nothing to do in the game anymore. And you are just constantly chasing to keep them happy by releasing these bits and pieces. Multiplayer games have it easy because essentially the players in the game are creating the game themselves. So you can just create events for them or whatever. Another good one is that make sure your game prototype and visual prototype are one and the same. This is a bit of a rarity. I've discovered a lot of people who don't think like this, but I found really good reasons for it. So when you are starting your game project and you do prototypes and you have an idea that this is the game I want to make and you do the prototype really fast, at the same time you have artists contributing onto that same project, making it prettier and prettier and prettier. one point, and it happens all the time, is that if you're not satisfied with your prototype, that I don't think this is going to make a really good game. At that point, like, the loss aversion really kicks in, because it looks really pretty. Like, look at those reflections. Like, that model is really looking really nice. And that's where you kind of feel that, I mean, we can't actually, I mean, we can't just throw all of this work into, like, nothing and start from scratch. Like, I'm sure we can do something about this. Like, I'm sure we can kind of, let's just keep working on it. It'll become better. And that's, like, that's something that was something that happened in natural motion, and we kind of really nicely tweaked it. That from that point on, when we had those experiences, we basically had two different builds. So you have the game prototype build that looks like a cat vomited on it, so it's like this weird color thing that just has the gameplay on it. And then you have a visual prototype that has absolutely no gameplay value at all, but it looks really pretty. So if it's a 3D game, all you probably have is a scene from the game, 3D camera, you can kind of move a bit, and it may be chosen asset. Like, if the example would be on CSR racing, then you would have the car on the street, but it wouldn't have any of the HUDs or any of the dials, because that would be done somewhere else. So that means that even if you feel that your game prototyping, the really ugly looking thing, hits a dead end, then it means that you can just, I'm glad to be rid of this, because this looks like shit. So we can just really easily start doing something else. So it's there's no loss aversion to the fact that, well, we did a lot of work. As long as your team is more or less in that kind of zone, if you're doing a car game, then it's really easy to do the visual prototype and not care about the gameplay at all. But this is something that I'm kind of holding with me for the rest of the life, because I've seen so many times where that loss aversion is really horrible. Like, you can kind of think that we're doing this prototype, and yeah, let's have Frank there do some graphics for us. And then Frank is feeling really motivated, and he just absolutely, like, smashes it when it comes to the graphics, and it starts looking really beautiful. Then you're in this trap that, oh, fuck, it's looking really good. So let's just keep on going. We can get to it. So, yeah, especially in 3D games, it's horrible 10 months into the game where you realize that, yeah, remember that core gameplay loop we did? That looked really cool, and everyone really liked it. Like, the game isn't actually fun. And at this point, you have, like, reflections going on there. You have, like, fucking changing weather patterns or whatever. Like, you just have this technological marvel that's not fun. So it's really expensive to backtrack from that. It's not nice. On the other hand, it's a bit of a paradoxical thing. Make sure your prototype is not presentable, which means that obviously make sure that whenever you present your game, it has to look like representative. Because a lot of people, like, if I give you, like, some of unfinished games to play, like, most people will give you feedback of the very obvious stuff. Like, it doesn't have the menu, the buttons doesn't work, I don't get what I'm kind of doing here. So the feedback can be really skewed. So you're not actually getting anything out of that. So whenever you present the game outside of your office, it's good to kind of think about, like, is it worth presenting? Am I actually getting any useful feedback? I try not. Yeah. So, how do I like, as a graphical person, how do I avoid that kind of graphic aspect of the kind of prototype making and all that stuff? I don't make many graphics on computer anymore. So a lot of the stuff you saw previously were drawn on a notebook, because I found out that if I do graphics on a computer, it kind of stumps on the toes of the real artists. So you kind of have a pixel art here, and then you have pixel art here. So it's kind of, you are kind of trying to say, tell to the artist that this is the way you should be doing it. But when you do it like just hand-drawn stuff, it's different enough that it doesn't cramp their style, so to say. But yeah, it's okay. And it's from a game, like, it's, I've done illustration and graphic stuff in 2008, was the last year I actually did a whole drawing. So it's been a while. So I'm not kind of, I have the illustration background, but I'm not bent towards it. I can appreciate the good graphics and quality where I see it, and I can give feedback on that, but I don't, it doesn't interest me, like, from a professional point of view. And then don't do any focus or user testing. So it's, just do what you, like, want to do. I'm sure you represent the whole audience. Also, waffle around with the art style forever. That that definitely makes sure that if you are always changing the art style, then you are always changing the menu graphics and all that stuff, and it just costs more and more and more and more. Don't care about the user interface or user experience design, so I'm sure the first pass on the menus is good enough. CSR Racing was pretty much ready for launch 4 or 5 months before it was launched, but the whole menu and all the user experience stuff was done again. And that was at the point where a lot of people couldn't see anything wrong with it. But that just shows you the kind of perfection streak that was kind of reigning in the company. Forget it, the fantasy of the familiar. Or just kind of skew it a bit wrongly. So this is Safari Kingdom. Yeah, I think that was the game from Digital Chocolate. It was like the first Facebook game Digital Chocolate ever did, and it looks really pretty. That's not a really good screenshot of it, but you have your own safari. You grow animals there, and then you see them come from like pups into full-grown animals, and then you release them into the wild because you're kind of like a conservatory of animals, and you want to keep them healthy and kind of populate the like rare species or even dinosaurs, and they can just like roam there. But the problem with this was that everyone really likes animals, especially if they look really, really cute, as they did in this game. So it almost feels like a loss when you have all these animals and now they've grown to adults and now you need to release them. So your safari suddenly becomes really empty. So it works on a Farmville game where you grow your carrots and then they're ready and then you harvest and you get the money. But in a game about animals, where people typically have a very personal contact or kind of relationship with them and stuff looks cute, you don't want to give up those. But in this game, you had to do it. So I think the kind of fantasy of the family was kind of fighting against a bit of like what people usually do. Go for it.
What if you could have visited them in the wild and see how they're doing?
Yeah, that was the question was like, what if you could have visited them in the wild? This was actually thought about. The guys actually had a screen where you could see all the animals you've ever released, but it felt a bit kind of backwards in a way, and then I'm not sure if that would have kind of, because that's not your main screen where you play. It still would be an empty safari when you get back to it. And then when you make your top hit game, believe the hype. So you probably did something really, really right. So this is the point to kind of say that, we now know how we are going to make games that make a really good amount of money. So I think one of my favorite examples is Daikatana from, like, what is it, like 2001 or something. So it was John Romero's company in Iron Storm. The guy had made Doom and Quake and all that kind of stuff. And then he goes to do his own company. So he does a time-traveling game about a weird cyber samurai guy. And they have so much money to spend because, this is like John motherfucking Romero. He's done Doom. So, like it's like a god just descended here. So he has to, like, know what he's doing. So the first thing the guys do is they start creating the game. They waffle around with what kind of a game they are making. Then they start hiring really rapidly, like, let's get, like, the best in the business here. Well, actually, it doesn't have to be the best in the business. We just need the best. So when it comes to art, it doesn't have to be a computer graphic artist, because any artist will do as long as he's really good. So they get a guy who's never touched a computer. He's done, like, a really, really good oil painter guy. And then they set him loose, like, let's just do assets for us into this game. So then one day, John kind of thinks that stuff isn't going the way it should be, and then he starts looking at like why is the game so like laggy and choppy, and then they start investigating, and then they see that okay, so some of the textures are really, really big. So obviously you have like when 3D games you have textures on all the objects, and that takes time and memory and all that stuff. So they find an arrow texture that's 1,600 pixels wide, which even on a today's monitor is a respectable size for a picture, but back in like 97 or whatever, it's quite big. So that's the traditional art guy doing art assets for a game. And when you play the game and you have an enemy that shoots an arrow at you, you will probably see 2 pixels of that arrow. And here, like, if you look it really, 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 really close, you will see that look at the fine wood graining on the arrow shaft. And then they realize that, yeah, okay, so, yeah, that's, like, when you have all the money in the world, you probably should be kind of careful of how you spend it. So it's worth to kind of don't believe the hype. I'm pretty nicely on time, so this actually took a lot longer than I thought. So I'm going to wax lyrical a bit on startups and design. So how many here have been a lead creative on a project and have seen it through? I'm kind of looking towards the game guys' direction. Okay, so how many of you guys kind of thought that you gave it all you got? Oh man, come on. Well, on that strain, like how many of you thought that the project outcome was really like phenomenal? Yeah, I mean, it's hard. Yeah, but I would kind of say that creative people are actually getting paid to fail. So even if we kind of give these projects everything we got, it's rare that it kind of feels like a home run. Like after all the effort, it kind of feels that I could have done, like, I mean, on hindsight, that could have been better, and that could have been better, and that could have been better. So it's kind of, I think it's for a creative industry, it's good to kind of realize, like, learn how to fail, or just kind of like deal with that. Because in the game industry, like, the change is constant, nothing is fixed. And some people attribute this to the kind of times at the moment. So who in here kind of thinks that we live in a fast world, for example? Like, do you guys think that the world is kind of moving faster than before? Well, you are very low stress individuals, I'm sure. Because there's not really anyone who kind of demands you to be fast, but there is that kind of overriding feeling that everything is moving like really fast, and you really need to double down on things. And on game development, sometimes when you are trying to be like really fast and you don't really think about things through, you will always kind of face the so-called oh shit moment. So this happens with every kind of startup or every kind of project. Like, even though it's on the 10% inspiration phase, everything is really good and everything is really cool, you should still think that at some point there will be an oh shit moment, and that's going to be a very kind of dividing thing in the project. Like, that's going to be important. It will come at some point, or then you just aren't ambitious enough. And your best hope is that it comes early so you can deal with it early. If you have experience, you can probably pinpoint that might be our oh shit moment. But you can't be sure because everything's feeling really good at the moment. And then when you know that the oh shit moment is there, if you kind of choose to ignore it, then I think the outcome is that no one will actually see you hit the ground when you wear makeup. So what does this tell you? You were actually concentrating on the wrong things. So when you are kind of smashing onto the ground and you're looking really beautiful, no one cares, because you should have concentrated on some other things than putting on the makeup. A good anecdote is from this is from the Bugbear times when we were doing the early flatouts. You have a racing game where you go like 200 miles an hour down a road. So what should you kind of concentrate there from a kind of level point of view? If you're kind of inexperienced, what you will do is, if this is your level and you need to do it, you will concentrate on all the trees. Maybe I'll put a shrub there, stone there, and maybe I'll put this thing here, and then I'm going to put a bit of grass here. And that's just like a half of, like a 50 times, like maybe like a meter by meter section of the level, which is like 3 kilometers long. So when you play the game and the car goes really, really fast, like, what, you probably have like 60 frames per second. So everything you just work for a few hours even, it's just going to be like a colorful blur on the like left side of the, like, unless you crash onto it. So if you are like on a very early stage, especially, like, no one cares like how much detail you put on the, like, that particular point, because you're not proving anything about your game. Like, you should kind of concentrate on the like feedback and that, just the kind of, like, if you want graphical quality, that's not the point where you kind of should put it. So, and this is a good example of the like the line or the difference between like a visual prototype and a gameplay prototype. So it's kind of it's something to think of, like, where do you kind of put your effort. So this kind of sums up that the game studios like regardless of what stage a game studio it is, to me it always feels that it is a never-ending startup, and they always live through constant change because the market is constantly changing and the way we play games is constantly changing. And unless you run it like a factory, it's also really exciting to work on this. But it just, you should kind of embrace the fact that you need to iterate really fast. You need to kind of keep your head at it and kind of know where you're going to put that makeup on. And it kind of revolves around these theses that nothing is actually fixed or permanent. Actions have consequences, change is possible. So that's very central to all like game studios. And the weirdest thing about this is that it is actually the basic tenets of Buddhism. I'm not into it, and I'm not kind of trying to convert you guys, but it is a very weird thing that these are the basic tenets of Buddhism, and then it also sounds like it's the basic tenets of any startup or even a game studio. So to kind of sum up the stuff, you need to be true to your platform, you need to know your audience and how are people playing these games, and make a game for that platform. Don't make a console game onto a mobile device. Do a console experience on a mobile platform. Know the core pillars, set them, make sure that your team kind of knows what you're kind of working on. Know what makes the player come back. Like you can even, like when you play games, you can kind of think of it yourself, like why should I come back here? And iterate as fast as possible and don't be slave to the metrics. Thank you.